There is a book about food, and more than food, here in Appalachia. It's called The Food We Eat, The Stories We Tell, Contemporary Appalachian Tables. The book is a collection of essays and poetry published by Ohio University Press and edited by Professor Elizabeth Engelhart of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with Laura Smith. Elizabeth joined me for a conversation, along with two contributors to the book. Emily Wallace, who lives in Durham, North Carolina, is art director and deputy editor of Southern Cultures Quarterly. Robert Geip, who lives in Harlan, Kentucky, and grew up in Kingsport, Tennessee, is a writer and producer of the Higher Ground Theater Project.
Elizabeth, Emily, Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, for pleasure having. To be here.
Thanks for having us, Ray.
Elizabeth, this book is focused on the food of today's Appalachia. Tell us how this book came about.
You've put your finger right on one of the things I care most about in this book. When Laura Smith and I sat down to talk about what a book about the foods of Appalachia might be, Laura is my co-editor on this project, one of the things we wanted to do was just really reflect the Appalachia that we know. It's a place that's really diverse. It's a place with a lot of interesting food stories. Some of them have family histories in this place tied to them. Some of them have family histories from other places on the globe tied to them. And so we tried to think about how could we, in a short, tight volume, capture that part of Appalachia we're so excited about. And so we went about it by asking people to tell their stories. One of the things that remains true about Appalachia, whether you're new here or whether your family has been here for a long, long time, is that sitting around a table and telling some stories is one of the ways that we get to know each other and is one of the ways that we preserve what matters. And it's also one of the ways that we work out where we're different. So the volume itself is organized around just a series of people's stories. And we tried to do it by thinking of objects that matter. This isn't a cookbook. It's not a list of recipes. So by organizing it around objects, whether it's the mason jar that your family canned with or a taco truck that you care about visiting or whether it's a salt shaker that you tucked in your pocket as you were going around and maybe raiding your neighbor's garden for a tomato in the height of summer. Those objects help us talk about who we are and what matters.
And this book focuses on a lot more than any certain caricature about Appalachia and anyone's expectations based around that certain caricature.
That's exactly right. We tell stories of beans and people who love beans in the mountains. I was thrilled to get to go home a couple of weeks ago and get my first summer half runners. But we tell also really meaningful stories from people's families, of Italian American families, of Cherokee families, of families that have immigrated from Central America and South America. And we think about the foods that people have here right now. So you're going to be hard pressed to find the kind of stereotypes about Appalachia, because rather than spending a lot of time talking about what we don't see, we wanted to spend time talking about what we do see.
Give us a few examples of what you do see.
One of the pieces in the book that I think picks up on your really good question there about the stereotypes comes from a couple of folks who drove up and down, particularly Virginia, North Carolina, into parts of Tennessee, looking at all the various wineries that are in Appalachia today. They do a little turn through how do those wineries advertise themselves and what stereotypes do they use or what images do they use. And what they found was just a huge range of ways to signal that this food, this wine was produced in this place. And it pairs well with a second piece in the book that really looks at the variety of tacos that you can find across the mountains today and the types of countries that those tacos owe a debt to, but also the new innovative ways using local ingredients or using imported ingredients where people are finding good food that they're producing for each other and eating.
And that brings us, speaking of pieces, to Emily and to Robert. Emily, you first. Tell us more about your contribution to this book.
So I wrote about a fast food chain that's based in Southwest Virginia and East Tennessee called Pal's Sudden Service. Kind of going to what Elizabeth was talking about, it's food that you might not necessarily on the surface think of as Appalachian that's kind of blown out of proportion. Pal's is known for, has these gigantic hot dog, hamburger, french fry, and soda sculptures affixed to these teal buildings. Driving through the landscape, in some spots you'll see like a beautiful mountain range and then this fast food chain with a gigantic hot dog. That's how I first encountered Pal's. I went to college in Southwest Virginia and I have family in East Tennessee and was driving kind of back and forth down Interstate 81 and first encountered this spot. As I was saying, you might not consider hot dogs Appalachian food, but the thing I really like about Pal's is, first I'll say hot dogs kind of have an important history in the region. There's Valley Del was a producer of bright red hot dogs. It was a big industry in itself making that food, but also an important food that fed the region's workers. What I like about Pal's is that it kind of gives monument and place to this food.
And Robert Guype, tell us more about your contribution.
Of course, one of the things I loved about this book was it was like coming to a family table because I grew up on Pal's. I used to go to Pal's before I'd go to my mother's to eat Thanksgiving when I'd come in from out of town. It's like, it's a wonderful fast food place in my hometown. And the book includes another essay by a woman that whose family grew up in Harlan County where I did, Carita Brown, important scholar of African-American and history, in particular African-American coal miners. And so I was tickled to be a part of this book because it is a great look at the range of food. But it is also Annette Clapsaddle, I was thinking about her because her dad still operates a corn grinding mill in Cherokee, Sanook, the Sanook family mill. And she has an essay in there too, I think Elizabeth mentioned. But my contribution, I worked in a pickle factory and I was talking about it at one of those Appalachian Food Summit meetings. If anybody's wanting to get involved in this stuff, the Appalachian Food Summit's a good organization for getting involved. But yeah, I was a spear packer. I wrote a piece about spending my days. Before I was an English major, it was really the only quantifiable work I ever did. It's like I could pack 840 jars of dill spears a shift. That's all seed sides out. And I appreciate this opportunity to talk about that work and just agricultural work in general. I lift up all the people that do it. I know that one of the good things that come out of this pandemic is people have that might not have been thinking about people who pack their food, what they deal with. And it is intense work. It is dangerous work. And it is vital work. And so that's one of the cool things about this book. It doesn't just look at what people think of as traditional home cookery. It does also look at the role food's played in the economy in the region. So my little part was about being a spear packer. I lost a Band-Aid in a jar. That's the center of my... So it's called Confessions of a Spear Packer.
That gets a spoiler alert.
That's right.
A lot of people have been traumatized by that story, so I'd like to get it out there. Content warning.
I love how you said that because I wasn't interested in a project that was just really about kind of prissiness or purity in food. I was interested in what stories do we actually tell and what do we do in daily practice? There's another great piece in the volume by Courtney Ballester, and she's talking about her life in Detroit. She's originally from West Virginia, but finding Appalachian communities in large part by the Cool Whip containers that she was sent home with leftovers from social club gatherings of people who had moved out of West Virginia, and how that's one of the ways that she just recognized it. And the stuff that was in the Cool Whip container maybe was not exactly like her family made beans. It wasn't exactly the recipe they remembered, but the ritual, the practice, the care of you got to take something home with you. You're not going home with nothing. That's where the story is. That's where we care about each other. And that's where we continue to talk to each other.
There's the ritual. There's the practice. There's also, and it's been alluded to earlier, the sense of place. And I was struck by, in the introduction, talking about the mountains. Even when the mountains aren't there, they are very much present.
Yeah, I had the chance to riff a little bit on one of my very favorite essays in the intro to this book. And it's an essay by Ursula K. Le Guin, who was a writer primarily based out in the shadow of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. And I don't know if she spent much time in Appalachia, but I like to think that she would have recognized it. And she wrote an essay that's called The Carrier Bag Theory of Fiction. It spends a lot of time talking about the way we normally expect stories to rise and fall and the kind of arc of progress and the expectations we have for big drama. But what she lands on is saying that what's really interesting to her are the kinds of novels, the kinds of books where interesting characters and interesting objects just rub up against each other, knock around together. It's in the interactions where the stories are. And I think in Appalachia, because of our mountains, we're always in conversation with and reaction to those mountains around us. It shapes our memories. It shapes our daily life, even when we leave the mountains, even when we are trying not to pay attention to them, even when we're recognizing the ways we're connected to other places on the globe. At least for me, I always still orient toward, I grew up in the shadow of Mount Pisgah. That's the center of the world to me. And I come back to that.
Emily, Robert, how do you see it?
I was thinking about those Cool Whip containers, thinking about objects. I know a lot of people that think Cool Whip containers and Country Crock containers, that's Tupperware, right? that's what everybody carried stuff everywhere. And I think that, you know, that's part of it, is that people make do with what they have, but that's not out of lack. I think that one of the things about the landscape in the mountains, in these mountains, is the abundance. There's the abundance of tree species. There's abundance that you get all four seasons. There's abundance of plant life and animal life. There's this sense that people are lucky sometimes to be given maybe not money and maybe not a lot of material things that you buy at the store, but that what you have isn't just adequate. It's beautiful and abundant. And I think that is something that a lot of people I know, my favorite people anyway, draw from the mountains and their landscape.
In a different way, I mean, just thinking a sense of place. I grew up in Eastern North Carolina, so a completely different landscape than I moved to when I went to college. But I did grow up with this snowball stand in the middle of my hometown. It was shaped like the snow cones at Seoul. And so there was this funny, unexpected homecoming when I moved to Southwest Virginia and saw these Powell's buildings, sort of the unexpected playfulness and quirkiness that I didn't expect, and really kind of welcomed me there.
And in the end, it all circles back around to welcome, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we really hope that people can pick up a book like this one and find things familiar, find things brand new to them, reach out to us as authors to share their stories, have conversations around their own tables, maybe in this moment be invited to sit at a table that's not one they've been sitting at for a while and have that conversation. It's not always easy. Those tables don't always have enough food on them, but there is a graciousness of spirit when we think about inviting someone to sit together, to have a meal.
Well, Elizabeth, Emily, Robert, thanks for sitting down with us, albeit virtually, and sharing your stories and the stories of food in modern Appalachia.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.